I'll call Budget Legacy and Budget Stabilization Fund Advisory Board Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Chairman Tippenick?
Here.
Crate?
Here.
Senator Scott?
Here.
Nelson? Citizen Members Eric Hardmeyer?
Here.
Citizen Member Jim Marsup?
Here.
Citizen Member Pam Chart?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Okay. Well, this should be a fairly short session. I think basically what we're, there's, get an update from the Chief Financial Officer on how things are going, and, you wanted to consider, well, should we do that then? I didn't realize we were going to do the election and stuff, or chairman stuff right away and stuff on it here. Okay, yeah, let's just, why don't you, is there any consideration of the minutes for the December 1st meeting? Is there any corrections?
Move to approve the minutes.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Do we need a voice vote on that?
No.
Just a voice vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Okay, motion carries. Okay, then going down, I didn't mean to get ahead of myself here on that. I guess when I talked to Sheila, we were going to, I guess, put this back to the next meeting, but I guess as long as it's on the consideration of selection of a board chairman, I guess there's...
Mr. Chairman, shouldn't we wait to see what the selection process will be as to who will be selected for management?
Well, here's the thing. This isn't the management committee.
Okay.
It isn't. I think what I got told, I talked to Sheila before, and I think that you and Carolyn Rich, or Senator Wardner, appointed you two back again on the Senate side, and Representative Carlson appointed me and Gary back again earlier. So that part is taken care of that way. That's why they got that on the management selection, but it's not an interim committee. This is a, I don't know what it really is. It's an advisory board, and so it isn't really an interim committee to per se on it. But I'm assuming that if you don't check the box on the interim on that board, you probably might not be appointed. I don't know what all, you know, but that was what the indications were.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
As you mentioned, we were appointed by the majority leader of the House to this committee, and I'm assuming the Senate does the same. I don't know if there's bylaws for this group, but are we having to consider electing a chairman every
interim? Well, and we should probably get those out. When we originally started this, and there is some bylaws of how this works. The board does appoint the chairman, you know, does, and I don't know if it says anything on the terms or anything like that. Alan, I don't think it does in there, does it? I think it's just that we appoint the chairman, and if, you know, if the board's happy with the way things are, then you know, it isn't a big deal. But if they aren't, then it gives an opportunity to open it up if we want to change.
As long as it's an agenda item, you know, I'll make a motion to nominate Keith Kempenich for chair of the Legacy and Budget Stabilization Fund Advisory Committee.
Okay, it's moved and seconded. Any discussion? Do we need a vote on that then? A vote, or roll call?
Representative Chairman Craig?
Yes.
Excuse me, Kaepernick?
I vote for myself, yes.
Representative Craig?
Yes.
Senators Klein?
Yes.
Nelson? Citizen Member Eric Hardner? Jim Morissette?
Yes.
Citizen Member Pam Sharp?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion passed.
Okay, well, thank you. It, I'll try not to have too many meetings and all that. But, it's okay, we're down to the presentation. And what I, like I said, what earlier here, basically what we need to do is every 6 months is what we have to have a update, or it's required that we have an update. And then the chairman, I got to give a presentation to the budget section on this and how the fund's doing, I guess. And that's what basically this meeting is about today, is to see where we're at, and we should be on the finished up on implementing the what we did here a couple of years ago. And I think that's what we need to basically look at, is where we're headed with this, and have some conversation in the process. So with that, Dave, you want to introduce yourself, and we'll have some material I think you passed out, so we'll go from there.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board. For the record, my name is Dave Hunter. I serve as the executive director and chief investment officer for the Retirement Investment Office. I've had the privilege of doing that since December 2nd of 2013. To my left, your right, is Darren Schultz, who serves as our deputy chief investment officer and has been in that, done a wonderful job in that capacity for coming up on close to 3.5 years now. Hopefully everyone has some materials in front of them. There should be two. One is a presentation landscape, looks like this. The other one is a three-pager. I'm going to basically just speak to the presentation for the most part, but I encourage any questions or comments along the way. If I could direct your attention to page 3. First, we're going to cover the Budget Stabilization Fund. Page 3 summarizes the funding and disbursement history over the past decade. If you go back to 2006, you see a summary of all the money that's been contributed. Over the last decade, it totals about $567.4 million that's been contributed. To the column next over to the right, it's called Net Increase. That actually represents the income that's been generated off of the investments in the Budget Stabilization Fund. That approximates about $68.5 million. One more column over to the right is the income distributions out. That's what we've actually transferred out of the Budget Stabilization Fund. That totals a little under $41 million. You add it all up, it totals about $595.1 million that's in the Budget Stabilization Fund as of March 31st 2015. The largest component of that being contributions over the past decade, along with about $68 million of investment income. On to page 4, there's a one-pager that shows our asset allocation for the Budget Stabilization Fund. If you recall, it's 100% short-term fixed income in Bank of North Dakota CDs. Pretty straightforward there. If I can have you turn to page 5, this is probably what I think most people are interested in at this point in time. Page 5 summarizes the results for the Budget Stabilization Fund for the period ending March 31st, 2015. For the one-year period ended, the Budget Stabilization Fund generated a return of just over 2%, 2.04%. So if you step back and you think about it, 2% is not a huge amount of money, but this fund really, it's a rainy day fund. It's invested in short-term fixed income assets, generally from 1 to 3 years in term. We have a policy benchmark, which is if we were investing in kind of index securities as opposed to using active management, we would have expected a return of about 0.8%. So active management is working quite well. Between the combination of the Bank of North Dakota Match Loan CD program and our Babson and JP Morgan, we've generated a return of a little over 2% after fees. Net, it's about an excess return of about 1.2%.
Dave, on, you know, and we, I think at our last meeting, we had the discussion about the Budget Stabilization Fund and the Bank of North Dakota. What is, and Eric probably can update us too on the act, is it, are we active with that now, or how is that working?
You want to take a stab, Dave? I'd be more than happy to. Thank you very much, Mr. Hardmeyer. Mr. Cabinet members of the advisory board, when we last met, we actually proposed a change in kind of our investment policy statement. What we were looking to do was to change from a hard dollar limit of $200 million to a percentage allocation that actually Mr. Representative Gary Craig actually suggested at a point in time. So we've actually suggested that idea to the state investment board. We haven't actually had a final discussion on it. There is a side memo that I wrote that kind of comes into play that's probably worthwhile discussing after Mr. Hardmeyer gives a little bit of update at this point in time right now as well. But just so you understand, as of right now, we're living with kind of a $200 million program limit. We also apply the 35% limit that was approved by the advisory board back in December. And if you look at page 6 in these materials, you'll see that the Bank of North Dakota CD program approximates almost $103 million as of March 31st, 2015. So it's this diagram or this chart, and you'll see the total budget is about $595 million, and the next line is Bank of North Dakota CDs. So as of right now, we're using a little over half of our capacity, but I know from talking in prior discussions with Mr. Tim Porter, who serves as CFO as BND, and Mr. Hardmeyer, who serves as president, that there are a significant amount of new initiatives that are out there that are looking to be built going forward.
Any questions, committee? One of the things that I think and kind of brought home here this last session was that, and it might not, depends on where everything lays here in a year or so, but there was a lot of discussion about, you know, the use, you know, the budget stabilization and the and using it actually as what it was meant to do, you know, but I don't think that we'd ever get into this part of it, and that was one of the conversations we had, you know, is how liquid is, you know, is this if you did start to tap into it and stuff on it, and that was one of the conversations, and I don't know if we need to have some guidelines on how liquid this would be with what we're doing and stuff on it, I think was probably one of the concerns.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, the BAPS and J.P. Morgan programs or mandates, which represent about $485 billion, that has a high degree of liquidity. We could probably liquidate that over a course of 5 to 10, even in a tough market, probably 20 to 25 business days. It's highly liquid. The Bank of North Dakota National CD program, it's a little bit of a different issue, but having said that, we are actually in the process of working out an investment management agreement with Mr. Hardmeyer, Mr. Porter, with BND, in which we provide more guidance and clarity about what the terms of the liquidity would be going forward. It's a document that we've been working on for quite some time. We look forward to actually sharing it with the BND later this week. And it should help to address some of those key concerns about just how liquid is this investment overall. Overall, I'd say it has a great deal of liquidity in this program, given the fact that the BAPS and the J.P. Morgan programs, which represent over 80%, are really the vast majority of that liquidity can be tapped in 5 to 10 business days, which is
and
great.
And that's always been a discussion, you know, in my mind anyways, has been how liquid, you know, because that's been one of the problems, because you do, you know, the return, we're taking a low
yes.
return on this for that reason, but how liquid could the person, you know, how, you know, what's the lines that you could draw, you know, and look at increasing the returns on it and yet still serve the purpose of what this fund was for, and that's been a question in my mind here for ever since we've really started getting any money into it. There's been, you know, because the way this works, usually it's a year out, you know, usually you can see stuff happening a year, you know, in advance. It isn't something that happened, you know, you're doing this one month and then the next month you're not, because even with, you know, now we've change this trigger formula, that more likely won't trigger, and then it'll go into effect in December at a different rate anyway, so we really take away some of that volatility outside of the prices and stuff on it. How, you know, do we need that quick of liquidity, or do it, there, is that, is there any options, I guess, is what is a question in my mind with this fund?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, something would be a good takeaway for Darren and myself to come back at the next meeting and provide, kind of, here's a liquidity profile, and what we're giving up from a return by being as liquid as we are, because it sounds like that's a key question you want to address. Having said that, the fixed income markets are just very low-yielding these days. It's just, it's a challenging market. The 10-year U.S. Treasury is about probably 235 in the five years alongside of this, and we're generally trying to manage to a 1 to 3 year term, so we're You can't have high expectations. If you want to truly maintain the fact that it is a rainy day fund. But that's something we can follow up, give the advisory board a little bit more clarity and understanding about here's the liquidity profile and what type of returns we're giving up.
Representative Craig.
Yep. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And Dave, I think it just hit upon that. You know, to keep this fund as liquid as we are at this point, you know, a 2% return net is a pretty good return, I would think, on the investment, you know, where interest rates are at today. If, you know, we see interest rates start to tick up, then we might, you know, see a differential there. But 2% of available money, still, you know, making some money on that money isn't a bad return.
I would concur wholeheartedly. As sad as that is, with 2%, it's just a function of where we are in the interest rate cycle right now. But perhaps Mr. Hardmeyer would have some perspective on that as well.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, it might be helpful if I back up a little bit. We just talked about the match program and what we're trying to accomplish with that. I know Dave has talked about the fact that there's $100 million outstanding and the likelihood that, you know, we'll continue to look at projects that will require more than that. And in fact, you know, probably up close to the limit of $200 million. So our recommendation when we came to Dave a while ago was that, in fact, the $200 million limit was something that we were going to run into. We requested an increase, as you may know, up to $300 million. And what we compromised back to was this 35% allocation. And as it turns out, what we may have thought was going to happen was that more money was going to be put into, you know, the budget stabilization fund than it did. And so we are going to see no opportunity to extend that limit from $200 million to even $250. But I will tell you that it's very likely we're going to reach that cap of $200 million in the next 6 to 9 months. So I just want to give you that background. Since 1991, this, you know, SIB has provided the funding for this. And again, it's because DOD does not have a long-term source of deposits. All our deposits are short-term. So that is why we use this fund to fund our long-term projects with the match program. So I just wanted to give you that background again. In terms of, you know, interest rates, you know, certainly I see it the same way Dave does, that I would guess later on this year the Fed will start moving rates. You know, I'm sure June, I don't know what the odds are that there will be zero increase, but certainly I would guess September, you know, maybe later on this year we'll start to see some short-term rate movement. And a lot of that, you know, who knows about the long-term rates, but to your point, Representative Pratt, it's not a bad return right now.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Eric, so the fact that you're going to run out of money in 6 to 9 months, is that going to be a kind of hamstring you guys as to some of the projects that you had intended to help with, just kind of more from my information or our information?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. So that's why we were out here, you know, a year ago saying, you can see we're going to run into this limit. You know, is there an opportunity to increase that from 200 to 300 million? So it does provide challenges to us. We'll have to do some out-of-the-box thinking of what we can do internally to generate additional funds for this program. So it can be done. It would have been cleaner and easier to do it this way. But we think it's an important tool in the economic development toolbox in North Dakota. So we're going to have to figure out a way to continue to put more money into that summer climate. So whether it's another $100 million or $200 million, you know, B&D will have to figure out a way to do that.
Go ahead.
And just a reminder to me, that's pretty safe dollars, wasn't it?
Well, we think so, Senator Klein. The money that's put into the bank is put in the form of a CD, which is backed by the full faith and credit of the state of North Dakota, which carries, you know, a triple A minus rating. So, yeah, there's no credit issues that SIB has with this. We take the credit risk. It's a default on the loan. B&D absorbs the loss, but the deposit is fully guaranteed by the state. So, yeah, there's no credit risk to the state in that regard.
Yeah. See, and committee, and I think that's, you know, truthfully, I think that's you know, and I was looking at this, and I had a conversation, and that was one of the things that I think that why I asked about the liquidity part, you know. But I think what we need to do, though, is we're going to have to educate more legislators on how this works too, because I think they're, you know, because I got a little pushback even at the 35% here at the, you know, during the session, especially about halfway through it when oil was down in the 30s, and they were actually starting to look at this. And I told them, I said, well, we're kind of committing here, you know, I mean, what's, you know, and I think that this liquidity issue, you know, how, you know, this could be used and still use it is going to be something I think we're going to have to struggle with, because it doesn't, you know, if we can use it, then, you know, my feeling is if we can use it and something that we still follow the intent of what this is supposed to do, you know, and feel comfortable doing that, you know, it doesn't make much sense to have it just sitting there if we can use it, you know, and still have the intent of the what the statute says and stuff on it. And I think that's, you know, we're probably going to, this is going to be an ongoing conversation for me anyways. It is, because it's always been something that, you know, you want these rainy day funds available. You don't want to risk them, but you also, it'd be nice to be able to use it for something too and stuff on it in the process of it, but that's something that we're going to have to, I think it's more of an education process than anything on it with other legislators or how this all works. And I don't know if, you know, if you know, Eric or Dave, if, you know, if a person could put together kind of an outline or something on, you know, like, say we do want to change, you know, because it hasn't even been implemented. This hasn't even been implemented on it. And I think the intent was to try to get to about 250 on it. And as things kind of turned out, you know, it didn't work out quite. But I think it is kind of, you know, to be able to use it too. So, and I don't know how to educate other legislators on it, or if we get questions. It's mostly coming from the appropriation side of the coin is where the education needs to take place, is that they understand, you know, understand how this, if this would start to trigger, you know, as we do run into budget issues and stuff on it, and how it would trigger and stuff on it. And I don't know if that would be feasible or not to try to get something put down so we have a little better conversation about it, I guess, is the biggest thing. Representative Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, across the board, you know, if you do put a presentation together, they could present it to the budget section, who would include, you know, all of the members of both the Senate and the House Appropriations Committee sometime during the interim. I think it would be, you know, a good education for everybody to be able to hear that. And just a suggestion, but I think that's something that we, an agenda item for the budget section.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, it makes perfect sense that the key issue is more liquidity than, as Mr. Hedmeyer said, credit. So, working through the investment management agreement, and defining liquidity requirements or expectations along with our two existing $485 million liquidity providers, investment managers, bring the whole picture together and just to present a very straightforward, what I would think would be easy to understand kind of message about, it's a rainy day fund. You're concerned as much with liquidity as returned, and just lay it out there and say, here, this is the best opportunity that we see at this point in time. Share it with the advisory board, share it with the state investment board, and then make a recommendation and move forward. So.
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to do, committee, you know, because I think we're running into, because I know, like the banks, you know, invest, or what they're going for is longer term than what we got in mind, but it's more of that this fund, the timelines, you know, if we do need to use it, is this, the bank is this, and how we could address it if we do ever start to use it, you know, and that's what becomes the big issue is that, you know, if you got to use it, and you know, at some point in time we probably will, you know, I'm hoping hopefully I'm not around here when we do, because it's going to be ugly if you got to start tapping it. That's the biggest thing when you start reading how to tap this. I mean, things get pretty, you know, you get into a 5% allotment, and then you get, before you even start tapping this, so you're going to have a lot of forewarning before you ever start using this fund, you know, well, any of these rainy day funds, basically, there's going to be, things are really going to go south on us, and so that's one of the things, though, is that we have to have the assurances, though, that it's available if we do need it, and I think that's, we need that type of document that kind of shows that it is. So, anything else, committee? Okay, well, I guess we can go to the next item, I guess, established that it's not bad at 1.8, 1.2% on that, what we're doing with it, and I think that's the big key, is I don't think, like I said, I don't think we're looking at a 10% return on this, but it'd be nice to just, you know, be able to use it, so. Well, with that, Dave, we can go to the next slide you got there.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to direct your attention to page 8, and it just has a timeline of the legacy fund over the past 18 to 24 months. Back in April 2013, this was when the new strategic asset allocation for the legacy fund was approved. In June of 2013, the State Investment Board approved an 18-month transition plan. That transition plan actually took place, but started in August of 2013, and actually wrapped up earlier this year, January 2015, is when it became fully implemented. So, it was a successful implementation. I think when we talk to returns here shortly, you'll come to understand that, and it's great to be fully implemented at this point in time. On page 9 is a summary of the legacy fund funding and disbursement history over the past 3 years. You'll see, you know, going back to 2012, when the initial funding was made in September 2011, it was a little under $400 million put in. Over the next 3 fiscal years, it's grown to almost $3 billion of new money that has been put in. We've earned about a little over $214 million on those investments over the past 3 years. Please recall that for the most part, it was really invested in short-term fixed income during that time frame. It's only as of January 31st, 2015, that we came fully implemented in our new asset allocation strategy. As of March 31, 2015, the market value of the legacy fund is just under $3.2 billion. So, nice growth.
Dave,
yes.
When you say fiscal year, is that from January till May, I'm assuming?
The fiscal year actually runs from July 1 through June 30th, so it follows kind of that fiscal year period. So we didn't really reporting on a March 31 yet here. Page 10 just shows a summary. A nice colored chart shows how the different kind of flows have come in from either oil extraction taxes, oil productions from the CIF, or from CIF transfers from the land and legacy fund. You see, you know, just the nice ramp up in size. And again, the red line, you know, has grown to about $3.2 billion as of March 31 2015. On to page 11, it's just a simple summary that shows our actual asset allocation back on August 1st, 2013, when we commenced the transition strategy, was actually 100% short-term fixed income. Where we're at now is the policy allocation in the lower right. It is 30% broad U.S. equity, 20% international equity, so a total of 50% in equity investments. The big green box is 35% allocation to fixed income, and the two remaining pie chart pieces are 10% from diversified real assets and 5% to core real estate. So big picture, 50% equity, 35% fixed income, and 15% what I would call diversified real assets.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Mr.
Dave, on the fixed income side, we have a 35% allocation, and maybe you're going to do that. Could you go into some detail in terms of how you have that invested?
Absolutely. If you would like to flip to page 14. So I'm skipping a few pages, which I'll go back and cover, but to address the question now. The lower left-hand corner of the page represents a fixed income allocation, in which we have at least a half a dozen managers, including Western Asset Management, Prudential, Declaration, State Street, and Wells Capital. We have a variety of managers there. Some of them were short-term fixed income managers. For the most part, these are longer-term strategies now, effective with the full implementation of our asset allocation. They include assets such as Declaration, which is a total return fund that invests heavily in mortgage-backed securities, PIMCO, Disco, and Bravo, which are more kind of distressed credit opportunity funds, Prudential, which includes a high-yield component to it. Western and State Street is actually a long-term U.S. Treasury investment, very conservative U.S. Treasury investment holding. And then Wells Capital is kind of a lower investment grade, high non-investment grade kind of crossover credits. Overall, probably about a single A strategy overall. But does that address your question?
I'd like to follow up. The Western asset you said is primarily invested in U.S. long-term treasuries?
I'm sorry, actually that was State Street. If I misspoke, State Street was the long-term U.S. treasuries.
Okay, and so when you say long-term, Dave, how long are you out with treasuries?
We go out 10 to 20 years. 10 to 20 years. So it is a managed treasury. Dan, can you clarify that a little bit on the State Street investment account for me? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, the State Street is a government credit index, passively managed to the Barclays Gov Credit Index. So it's similar to a Barclays aggregate type mandate. Western is we call it core plus light internally. It includes up to 10% in non-investment grade, like high yield securities. Prudential is core plus. It can go as high as up to 25% in plus sectors like high yield. Mm-hmm. And as Dave mentioned, the PIMCO strategies are private credit strategies. Declaration is a securitized mandate, and then Wells Capital is a corporate bond. Corporate bond mandate.
Okay.
But generally speaking, the quality is high overall.
Yeah. Duration on the State Street when you're managing to the Barclays, what's your duration?
It's probably 5.5 years, I would say, overall. In the aggregate, I think the overall portfolio duration is probably in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the total program.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chair.
Is there any other questions, committee? Well, as long as we're on the fixed income side of it, because that has been in the news lately, the bond markets aren't really all that hot anymore. And they haven't been for a while. And what is kind of the general outlook? Because I know I was reading something here the other day that PIMCO was basically going to the sidelines with a lot of their stuff. What is kind of the the outlook on, because I'm assuming we're buying as we speak, you know, and stuff on it, because if that's what we need to do, and I was just kind of wondering what is kind of a longer, you know, is this something that's a correction, or is the interest rates start going up? What is kind of the outlook on the bond market?
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, we do use active management within all of our strategies, including fixed income. In general, we probably have a tendency to have selected managers who've more recently, historically, have been shorter duration rather than long duration, so it provides a little bit of protection that in the event rates were to rise quickly, they wouldn't feel as much of the pain as a index investor that is held hostage to the kind of the Barclays aggregate index strategy overall. We also use investment managers that invest in different types of corporate credit products or MBS products or CMBS, different types of strategies including some type of distressed credit private opportunities funds that generally have shorter duration, so they don't have as much risk, and they pay a better return overall because there's an additional credit component to it. But it is an overall managed strategy. So big picture, we do look as fixed income as a risk diversifier, but in this current interest rate environment, which rates have been low for so long, and the expectation, as Mr. Hermeyer was referencing, is that the Fed could, you know, very easily, I don't believe in June, probably later this year, look to raise rates, and then you have to be very conscious of the fixed income managers that you select, that they're very duration sensitive, that you make sure that they're comfortable with where they're at on an overall kind of investment risk perspective from that quality. And then how else do they generate income? By looking outside of just index strategies or investing exclusively in U.S. Treasuries where there's no credit risk. Does that address your question?
Well, it does. It's a complex question.
Yes.
Not only within the national, it's global, and I think what's going on over in Europe right now, I think, is putting more of that market is more questionable of being even into any government bond might be questionable, you know, if it's, see what Greece does, but I wouldn't want to be holding any Greek bonds right now.
You know? Oh, that's a great point. For the 1 year period ending March 31st, 2015, if you were invested in international, just a broad international debt, you would have lost close to 10%. Given what's going on with the strength of the U.S. dollar and kind of the interest rate environment and everything that's going on with the euro area. So having said that, do we have some investments in international debt? We do, but we also have a very healthy allocation of U.S. domestic fixed income, particularly in more opportunistic credit strategies that have done quite well for us. It's probably a good segue to look at page 13, which shows our performance. So for the 1 year period ending March 31st, 2015, the legacy fund, after investment fees and expenses, generated a return of about 5.72%. It's not bad. Versus our policy benchmark, if we're just doing kind of index strategy, we've been about 5.39. So we generated about one-third of 1% of active management or excess income by using kind of active management. So that's good. That means that the investment managers that the state investment board is selecting to implement our strategies are doing better than the index after fees. And that's a pretty nice story. Now you sit back and you say, geez, what is our long-term expected return for the legacy fund? It's actually about 6.4%. This is 5.7. It's less than that. But then you have to take into account that we were not fully implementing into this strategy until January 31st of 2015. So if you take that all into account, we've actually outperform even though we didn't hit the 6.4% because we're in the process of transitioning our asset allocation over the past 12 to 18 months.
Okay. Any questions, committee? Go ahead.
Dave, you know, the allocation that we have today, kind of the 50-35-10-5, any thoughts about that? Are you comfortable with that kind of allocation? Any recommended changes, or you think that's from a good allocation?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hermeyer, at this point in time, I'm comfortable with that allocation. We will, the fact that we've kind of just completed the whole transition, you should always step back and sense, given the dynamic nature of the markets, come back and say, geez, are we still comfortable with that allocation going forward? So it's something that we continuously look at, and at this point in time, there's no additional recommendation to change that allocation at this point in time, although we will continue to review it on a regular basis and come back to the advisory board in addition to the state investment board with any recommendations as warranted in the future.
Any questions? Okay. But I see you're getting into the fees and stuff. That is going to be the next question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, the information that I have in here on fees is stale information. So I look forward to updating this fee information after we close out our fiscal year end, June 30th of 2015, very soon. But this just goes to show you how much we paid for fees across our various strategies. And this is on page 15 for the legacy fund. And I'm just going to just touch on a few things here. So if you look at the domestic large cap, we paid about 23 basis points, about 0.23%. Small cap, we paid about 0.44%. International, very comparable, about 0.42. Domestic fixed income, about 0.35%. Diversified real asset managers, about 0.38%. That was a very small allocation. The highest, most expensive asset class that we invest in at this point in time is real estate, about 1.01%, all in all. We do that through JP Morgan and Invesco. We actually have pretty good leveraging relationships with them, but it isn't a more expensive asset class to invest in. Having said that, our real estate investments have done pretty well for us. We generated about over a 10% return for the 1 year ended. So even after fees, generating a 10% return is a nice strategy for real estate overall. You add it all up, for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2014, we spent about 0.27%, a little over a quarter percent. That's going to increase significantly for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2015. And if you step back and think about it, it's because we're now fully implemented into all of our strategies now. So hopefully that's a good high-level summary of it, and I look forward to bringing to the advisory board the more current numbers when we get them as of June 30th, 2015.
Any questions, committee? I just one. I'm assuming the higher the fees, the more active the management is. What's driving that?
Generally, that's a safe assumption to say. It really depends on what you're invested in. So if you go back a year or two ago, we were invested in short-term fixed income strategies. There's not a lot of excess return you can generate in short-term fixed income. There's a very small ability to really create additional income there. When we look at some of these other strategies that have higher fees, such as real estate, there's generally a greater ability to generate some excess income. So that's generally what you see associated with it. But your statement holds true.
You know, and we've brought this up before, and I know during the session that we had a few legislators, you know, What is the cost? Did you do any breakdown? I know Representative Kaiser was pushing the issue earlier during the session about getting, you know, local investors, sure, you know, or managers in, and the fees associated with doing that, you know, on smaller amount. Did you do any, or was that ever discussed in those? I sat in on one hearing that they had, you know, and it really never got touched on very well. And I was just wondering if you've ever done anything, you know, costs or, because that's one of the things, and we've dealt with that earlier when this fund got initiated, was we had people, you know, local, you know, within the state and stuff looking at trying to get into the markets or get into this, and that was one of the things that always went back to those, you know, one thing was cost, and then how to, you know, if you get management, you know, the management part of it, I guess, gets to be the question when we do this. And
sure.
I was just wondering if you've ever done anything that way.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, I'm just going to step back a little bit. So between the fiscal year ended June 30th and the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2014, we were successful in driving down investment management fees for all state investment board clients about 0.14%. So 0.14, 0.014%. A small number, but we went from about 0.02%, about 65 basis points, down to about 51, so a little over. When you take that 14 basis points and you multiply it times the fact that the state investment board client assets under management now exceed $10.5 billion, you're talking about $15 million of savings a year. So we spend a lot of time, a significant amount of time, working with our investment managers to drive down fees. One of the ways we do that is by leveraging our relationships. In general, we're making $100 million allocations to investment managers or $200 million allocations to investment managers, not 10 or 20 million. And the reason why we do that is it's economies of scale. By investing in a larger scale but still well diversified given our size of our asset base, we were able to just get better fees, lower reduction in fees. We're more top share of our investment manager's mind, and we get what we hope to believe are some of the best pricing out there for the dollars that we're investing. So we spend a lot of time on kind of looking at fees. And kind of one of the big challenges, if you look at sometimes smaller firms, they don't have the ability to actually provide a $100 million mandate because of the size of their institution overall. If you have a firm that's only $1 billion, which is quite sizable, $1 billion is huge, but if we were to make a $100 million investment in a firm that's only $1 billion in size, it'd be a bit of a concentration risk or a concern to them. And it's kind of a two-way street. It's a risk to them as well as a risk to us. So historically, it's been hard to find kind of the best opportunities with the smaller local institutions to find where we can play. Having said that, we're always looking at it to see if there are potential opportunities, and it's something that we will continue to explore going forward, because there could be some good opportunities out there. We just need to make sure that we're selecting that and focusing that in a very intelligent, direct, and cost-effective manner.
Is Callan still, is that kind of your overall advisor yet, or do you have other firms that you got?
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, Callan is our lead investment consultant. I think they've been our investment consultant, seems like, for about 25 years. I have great regard for Callan. I was not as familiar with Callan prior to coming into this role. They do a wonderful job for us. They know our history. They know our managers. They know our team. They do a wonderful job, I think, kind of presenting what they deem to be the best advice. It's still up for us to make our decisions on what we think are the best managers, just like what the advisory board and State Investment Board does. But I think they do a wonderful job of helping us identify the top select group of managers that we want to focus on when we have a new investment mandate.
Well, and that was one of we choose Darby Kuhn to do this was, you know, and I had nothing against Callan, I told him that when we were, but it's nice to get different, but you find out in a hurry there isn't many players involved in especially this institutional investing. There isn't many players in it, and that's what, you know, and that's one of the things, you know, and like I said, I can understand, you know, and we went through this, there is a learning curve, and I told Representative Kaiser that when he brought that up, that there is a curve here that, you know, you're going to have to understand where this is all going, and that's one of, you know, and that has been one of my big things, and I think the committee is too, is that, you know, as these numbers do get bigger, your costs become very, you know, it might be small when you look at it, but boy, that really starts adding up when you start to put bigger numbers to it. And you really, it doesn't take much more to manage $1 million as it does $1 billion and stuff on it. And that's what gets kind of concerning is when you start looking at, you know, the prices and stuff or the costs on it. So is there any questions, committee? Mr. Hagmeier.
Dave, you talked early on about it, but you did 6.4%.
Yes.
The overall return were at 572, it looks like.
That's correct.
I think I also heard you mention that the real estate portion is doing very well at a 10% return, really. My question, Dave, do you have all the returns by asset allocation?
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, Mr. Hagmeier, yes. So we have a website, and we publish the information on a quarterly basis, so I can go to the website and just pull it up. So just to restate. So,
is it something to get here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Been helpful.
Absolutely. So the real estate returns for the current fiscal year to date approximated 10.12%. So, but yes, I can be happy to provide that information. So it breaks it down by manager, by asset class, in comparison to a performance benchmark. Some benchmarks are more meaningful and relevant than others. Real estate benchmarks are tough.
So you have a breakdown for all of these categories, Dave?
Yes, we do.
Could you read them off to me? Maybe simple a bit?
Yeah, it's
good. Like broad U.S. equity, what's for?
So I'm holding, this is for the legacy fund.
Yep.
So this is, I'd be happy to provide, I can read it to you if you'd like.
I'd like to read it, please.
Okay. I'm going to provide fiscal year-to-date returns for large-cap domestic equity were 8.56%. For small-cap domestic equity were 4.24%. International equity was a negative 0.44%. Total fixed income was 3.58%. Diversified real assets, which is predominantly at this point in time, because we're in the process of doing the implementation of the asset allocation over the past 12 to 18 months, was a negative 0.8% at that point in time. Negative 0.8, so that really consisted predominantly of a Western TIPS fund, I believe. Yeah, is that correct? Okay, so a Western TIPS fund, TIPS for Challenge, with the low inflation environment that we've been living in of late. And real estate, as I indicated before, was 10.12%. And this information is all publicly available on our website.
Thank you, Dave.
Yes.
Okay.
Those were current fiscal year-to-date returns through March 31st, 2015. So starting July 1, 2014 through March 31st, 2015. Going forward, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, I'd be happy to include this detail in the package, since it sounds like it would be very helpful.
And the cash part, is that just the money that got deposited in and then hasn't been invested yet on that? Why are we carrying, you got some cash equivalent, is that just deposits?
Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board, so we do get significant cash inflows. We're blessed to have that problem of having significant cash inflows each month. We do our best to allocate those on a very timely basis. We work with the treasurer's office in advance to know those funds flows. You still have to do some timing of ins and outs of transactions with all of our clients. In general, it's a pretty small amount that we have invested in cash and cash equivalent at any point in time.
Yeah.
You may see a number at March 31st that is higher than what you would normally see throughout the period. And it's just because of funds flows near the end of a month.
Well, there wasn't much going in there during the spring. It dropped below. You guys see we're up over 41 was the last one, but I know it got down into the 30s, and you're starting to say it kind of reflected what the oil income was coming into the state. And that, as I told somebody, I said, you got to look at this, that what the rest of the state was getting, you know, if we're getting 30% of it, we weren't getting much, because I think it was down, I think 31, it got down to about 31 million, and that only left about 90 million for the whole state. That's like I said, it gets a little interesting when you watch this, and we had that conversation earlier about hedging some of this, you know, but that gets to be a whole other conversation that does on it. So, is there any other questions, committee? Okay, well, it looks like we're doing what's expected of us. I was trying to think of, I think we need to, we'd like to get some more information. I think probably a little more detail on,
right,
on the management structure and the returns. I think that probably would, and I know this, you know, that TIPS, you know, and that was a conversation, I know, with RV, you know, and that was one of the things that, you know, you're trying to protect that, and it's been one of the concerns, and I think that's what was one of the concerns when we were in the fixed income, is that we stay ahead of the inflation rate, but who knew that we were going to, that you'd have zero interest forever, and I don't think that's going to be forever, but it seems like the inflation was, and it still is actually, you know, trying to keep your money together and stuff, and I think that's one of the bigger concerns, is that you do earn enough to when you capitalize this out into the future, that we still have the same dollar, at least the dollar we have today, at least have something to show for it 10 years from now too. So is that, because that's more of a longer term anyways, isn't it, on that, you know, like that like Western Global TIPS and stuff like that, that's more of, I mean, from a year to year type deal, that's more of a longer term. Well, this whole fund is a longer term than just trying to get something for this year or next year and stuff.
No, that's right, Mr. Chairman, members of the advisory board. It's a diversified asset policy that we have. There's going to be times when a TIPS portfolio will not be performing as well as we would like, but it's just, it's a function of what that asset class is giving us at that point in time. To step back and say there's times when U.S. equities have done very well over the past year, a little bit more challenge for this particular period for the international equities. But by maintaining a diversified asset allocation, holding true to it over the long term, we should generate the returns that we expect over the very long term. And to step back and say to generate a 5.72% return for the period ending March 31st, 2015, given that we're vastly still implementing our asset allocation policy for 10 of the last 12 months, not until January, is pretty good. So a nice strategy. All those numbers that I provide, so we provide audited financial statements every June 30th. I look forward to sharing the audited financials. These are unaudited preliminary numbers that we share. It's the best numbers that we have. We work with Northern Trust, our custodian, our investment manager, Callum, as well as all of our individual investment managers to come up with the best returns, the most accurate returns that we can provide. Highly confident of them and look forward to sharing the audited financials for the year ending June 30th, 2015 when they become available during the late third quarter of this year.
Any questions, committee? Okay, well, I guess that was easy enough.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your deal.
Nope, no problem. Well, as I was just thinking here, I guess council will need a... Can we get that together tomorrow?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we should have that to you this afternoon so we can prepare for tomorrow.
Yeah, because I think we've got most of it here and stuff on it anyways and stuff. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go back to the beginning of the committee and maybe ask the meeting Alan a question. We have a vice chair. We need to vote on the chairman. Do we need to do anything with the vice chair as well? Yeah, I thought we were going to do. I know in the past we did. Well, initially we didn't have a vice chair, and then when we selected the chairman a couple years ago, then we did have a vice chair. So, yeah, that's a good point. We should have somebody appointed to that as well. Jerry, if I made a motion with the vice chair, I move that we elect Senator Klein as vice chair.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? I guess we'll take a vote.
Representative Chairman Kipnick?
Yes.
Great.
Yes.
Senators Klein?
Aye.
Wilson? Citizen member Eric Hardmeyer?
Yes.
Citizen member John Morrison?
Yes.
Citizen member Pam Sharp?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion passed.
Okay. I guess I should ask, is there anybody in the audience or anything that has anything? Okay. Well, I think, like I said, unless there's anything changing, like I said, I thought if this big trigger went on and stuff, we'd probably have to meet again outside of this to see where we're at later on. But I think with the way things are stand right now, I don't think anything's going to change. So we probably won't meet again until probably in November sometime, try to put something together to get, so, you know, and then you'll have your reports. And I don't know if you want to, Dave, you know, send out some updated information ahead of time and stuff on it, I guess, to the committee. I think that's when we'll probably try to schedule it again sometime, either towards the end of November, first part of December, I think, on it. And with that, if there's any questions or anything like that.
Move to adjourn.
That's what I was thinking too. So, well, thanks a lot. Thanks for your time. We'll adjourn.